class.
All right. First, I just want to start with a big shout out to Batsheva, who joins us all the way. Nice to have you. Really great. Welcome back, everybody. Hope everybody had a restful and safe Shabbos. We are ready to begin number 11. We are coming in the home stretch. However, the home stretch is quite a long mile. Oh my. The last three are quite doozies. Number 11 of our 13 principles, Maimonides refers here and says, Ani ma'amin be'amuna shalema. I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed is His name, rewards with good those who observe His commandments and punishes those who violate His commandments. Ouch. This is an interesting one. Let's see if we can take a step back, as I like to do before we take a step forward. Let's remind ourselves of what number 10 was. Number 10 was the fact that God is aware, is supervising all of our actions, all of our deeds, all of our thoughts. He's aware of everything that goes on. So if you look at 10 and 11 together, what you have perhaps is a great expansion of a concept. And the two together are God is aware of everything, that's 10, and 11 is that God reacts to everything we do. He doesn't just observe from a distance and make note of it. There's going to be an accounting that needs to be made based on what we do. God reacts to what man does. Follow the commandments, that's called good. Break the commandments, that's not called good. And therefore, there are consequences to those actions. 10 says, I see all the actions. 11 says, I will respond, and there are consequences to those actions. But the question that I want to deal with this evening is, why is it necessary for God to know man's actions? Why can't God have set up a system of reward and punishment as an automatic? I'll give you an example. If you go ahead and you put your hand into a fire, there is a natural reaction to putting your hand in the fire, and that is your hand will get burned. It may not be for a bad reason. It may not be for a good reason. A child who plays with matches can get burned just as much as the firefighter who's going in to save the child. It's just a natural consequence of the world that we live in. So why is it that number 10 says God's aware of it and 11 says there's reward and punishment based on it? Why can't it not simply be that there's a system set up that's automatic? So I read a beautiful article based on this topic that my dean, Rabbi Weinberg of blessed memory from Ner Israel, spoke about. And he described that the difference between an action that's motivated by an awareness of consequences which are automatically follow, there's a difference between that and an action that's motivated by an awareness of the reaction God will have. How we approach it will really depend on what is motivating us. Yes, I know that putting my hand in a fire, there is a natural consequence. My hand will get burned. But who is the center of that concern? Me. The focus is exclusively on me. But if I go ahead and I do an action where it's not automatic, I do an action and I don't see the consequence of it, at least not in the short term, then the reason or the motivation why I'm not going to do it is not because I'm automatically going to get burned by it, but because I'm motivated, I don't want God to be upset with me. I don't want the other person or the other deity, the other in the sentence, who is aware of what I've just done and will hold it against me. Acting out of prudence, just reality, I want to avoid pain versus I'm going to avoid it because I love God. Am I acting for myself or am I acting for someone else? In a programmed world where everything is, this is the action, this is the reaction, this is what is the cause, this is now the consequence. In such a world, you can only consider yourself, how it's going to affect me. If I do X, this is what's going to happen to me, Y. But in a non-programmed world where it's not automatic, I have to consider the consequence, not because I'm automatically going to get either the reward or the punishment, just because it's automatic, but rather I consider and it relates to God's reaction and response. I've said many, many times in this class, and that is it's essential for man to have a relationship with God. It cannot just be, I live in my own world, in my own bubble. There is a God, and it's essential for me to have that relationship with God. Therefore, if there's no awareness of God and everything is automatic, then there's no relationship. It's as if God doesn't exist. However, right? The fact that it's not automatic. My actions causes God to be aware and thereby react to it shows he cares. My actions make a difference to God. My actions make a difference in the world. You see, if everything is just automatic, then what I do is really irrelevant in the scheme of things. It's just how it affects me. If I do it, then I get this. Positive, I'll get reward. Negative, I'll get a punishment. But it really doesn't matter in the scheme of things. But because that's not the system God set up, God set up a system where my actions are perceived by him and reacted to by him. Everything I do matters. God cares how I do. My life has meaning because what's this going to do with the relationship? There's a purpose in my life. A built-in system, in my mind, indicates indifference. It doesn't really matter what I do. As long as I have self-preservation, as long as it serves my goals, then great. You are irrelevant. Nobody in this world is relevant. God is irrelevant. But if we live in a world where everything matters, why does it matter? How do I know that it matters? Because there's a God who told me that your actions make a difference. I'm watching, not because I'm looking to catch you, but because I care. And if I care, then your actions mean something. It always bothered me. Everybody gets in a tizzy when we talk about Rosh Hashanah. Oh my gosh, Rosh Hashanah is coming. It's a day of judgment. Everybody, quick, let's start behaving. I'm reminded of a story that my mom loves to tell, that my brother and sister, who are both older than I am, were fighting like cats and dogs. And my mother turned to them and said, you keep asking, you know, why can't we have another child? Why can't I have a brother or a sister? All my friends are having other brothers and sisters. Well, maybe if God sees the way both of you fight, he doesn't want to give us another one. Fine, you go on. Maybe an hour later, my mother says that she hears my sister telling my brother at the top of the steps, Avi, let's hold hands when we go down. Maybe God will think we're friends and we'll get a new child. My mother tells the story. It's very cute. It happens to be my mother was already pregnant with me, but that's irrelevant. It's a great story about, yeah, let's see if, yeah, it makes a difference. You know why Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment? Yeah, it's scary, but ultimately it's the greatest gift of a loving relationship, of kindness. I shared with you in a previous class that I was a teenager and I wanted to go out Saturday night. And I asked my mom, I was going out, and I'm leaving out the front door. My mom says to me, where are you going? I said, I'm going out with friends. Who? And of course, she asked all the million questions that every teenager loves to hear, wants to answer all the questions. And at some point, I finally said, Mom, I'm just going out with friends. Bug off. Leave me alone. She says, sorry, it's my responsibility as a parent to make sure. Leave me, let me live my life. She says, the day I stop loving you is the day I'll stop caring. And that's what it is. Exactly what every teenager wants to hear, right, at that moment. But it's the honest to goodness truth. And that is, Rosh Hashanah is a day where we remind ourselves that God cares. My actions make a difference. It's not an automatic system, things just running on autopilot. What I do matters, not just to me and my family and my community and my country and my nation, but to the entire world. And how do I know? Because God cares. How do I know he cares? Because he wants to judge me, not to make my life miserable, but because he cares. The day he stops loving us is the day he'll stop caring. Perhaps this would explain why Rosh Hashanah comes before Yom Kippur. Logically, you would think, let's ask forgiveness, let's clear last year's slate, and then start the new year with Rosh Hashanah. But we don't have it that way. Our calendar has Rosh Hashanah first, and then not till 10 days later do we ask forgiveness. Forgiveness for what? The year just started. It's only 10 days old. So maybe some of us do have to ask forgiveness already at that point. But most of us probably don't. We're probably on pretty good behavior. So why isn't Yom Kippur before Rosh Hashanah? The answer is that maybe we lost our focus during the year and we forgot that my actions really do make a difference. Therefore, I first have to have a reminder that God is aware and takes a personal interest. He cares. He judges me. Rescue me from my apathy and inspire me perhaps to return back to my roots and inspire me to say, you know what? If God really cares about me, I need to do something for that relationship. Now we're ready to examine ourselves inside and ask for atonement for going astray and commit to be better. Rosh Hashanah needs to come before Yom Kippur because that's the time that reminds us that we do have that relationship. This is why 10 and 11, principles 10 and 11 go together. God's awareness of us and thereby has a reaction to us because our actions do matter. Now, this concept that God, quote, rewards and punishes really brings three major ideals into focus. And I don't know if we're going to get through all of them, certainly in the allotted time. But we're going to attack this first. The concept that there's a consequence to my actions is predicated that I had a choice. This is predicated on free will. Because think about it. It makes no sense to have a concept of reward if I must do something, if I'm compelled to do something, or I'm pre-programmed to do something or not do something. If it's predetermined, then there's no point in rewarding or punishing. It wasn't me. I'm hardwired to be that way. You can't hold me responsible. We would have no justice system in the world because everybody can claim, what do you want? That's just who I am. In fact, in high school, my dean said once, he was giving a class, and of course, one of us was acting out, and finally, the teacher called him out on it, and he says, Rabbi, what do you want? That's just who I am. He says, that's the crime, not the excuse. That's the truth. So the whole concept that there are consequences to our actions is predicated that we had a choice. The whole concept that there can even be a mitzvah, a commandment, is predicated on this. It's ludicrous to tell you, here's what you must do. Why? It's not in my DNA. That's not who I am. How could God ask me to do something? It's not who I am. Maybe my innate nature is not to be drawn towards that. Maybe I'm drawn towards other behaviors. It's impossible to ever deviate from what I'm hardwired. So the concept that there's a mitzvah, a commandment that God is asking me to choose to do or not to do, is predicated on the fact that I have a choice. God could never judge us, could never find us guilty. I had no choice is a simple solution. Therefore, Maimonides included with this concept within number 11, that there's reward and punishment, that's already included in this principle, that there is free will. It doesn't need to be a separate principle, excuse me, because it's predicated. There's no point in rewarding someone for doing something good if that's how they're hardwired. Or vice versa, to hold them responsible for something that they may have done wrong if that's how they're hardwired. The bottom line is that there is free will. And tonight, for the next few minutes, I want to talk about this concept. It's really a very important idea. The Mishnah tells us, Rabbi Akiva used to say that man is so loved by God because he was created in the image of God. Well, what does that mean? He was created in the image of God. Like we've said many times, God created us as a physical body and then infused within us a soul, a spiritual component. But what is so great about this gift? It's a unique power not given to any other creature. We're going to talk more about this. The result of which is the ability that I can shape and change the world. For good or for bad. I can beautify and enhance the world, or I can destroy and plunder it. I can utilize the resources, or I can abuse the resources. The very first story in the Torah demonstrates this. God put Adam and Eve in the garden and gave them a choice. Don't eat from that tree. From every other tree, go for it. But don't eat from that one. If we're hardwired, then what do you want? The answer is that we do have choice. It's reaffirmed at the very end of the Torah as well. Moshe says that he calls upon heaven and earth to bear witness. I have placed life and death before you, blessing and curse, and you shall choose life. It's a verse. Choose life. You get to choose it. The whole Torah of do's and don'ts presupposes that a person can choose and be responsible for his actions, and it's not predetermined. But wait, Rabbi Akiva goes further, and he says the gift of free will, of being able to choose, is nice. But you want to know what's even greater gift? Is that God told us that we have free will. Imagine a homeless individual, and you go ahead and you give him a lottery ticket. You don't give him a dollar, but you bought him a lottery ticket and you give it to him. And he begrudgingly puts it in his shopping cart and he moves on. And he never bothers to check what the winning numbers were that day. And guess what? He's holding the winning ticket for $10 million. It's one thing that he has the gift in his hand. Great. But if you don't know about it and you're not aware of just how powerful the tool is and how it can change your life, then what good is it doing? Holding the winning ticket and never checking the numbers is an exercise in futility. To go ahead, free will gives enormous power and potential. But if you don't realize it, you can't take advantage of it. You can live a life you can live the life of a beggar, when in reality, you have the opportunity to live as royalty. So let's explore for a minute. Why? What is the purpose of free will, and what difference does it really make? So many of the philosophers, many of the great Jewish scholars question, what is the purpose why God created the universe in the first place? Again, having already seen many of these principles, God is eternal. God always is, always was, always will be. Then why did he create a world? So without belaboring the point, we've talked about this, that God is called a tov. God is good. God is a meitiv. God bestows good. Okay, and obviously the word good needs further explanation, but that is the definition of God. He is the deity that wants to give goodness. Well, what's the greatest good that he can possibly give us? $10 million? Obviously not. There's somebody who's got more than 10 million. Oh, $1 billion. Whatever number you're going to put on it, I think everyone here understands that that can't be the ultimate good, because it can crash easily, i.e. COVID-19, i.e. the stock market. There's a million ways that can't be the ultimate good. So what is the ultimate good that God can give? Is a relationship with God himself. That's the ultimate good, because it's eternal and it's a connection to God. So to resemble and to draw close in a relationship with God is good. But God says, you know what? For me just to give it out freely without any earnings on the person's part, there's no free lunches. You don't appreciate it. Anyone who's a parent understands that when we give our children everything, or for the teenagers here who have been counselors, if you constantly just give to the camper, right? There's no earning of it, then they don't have an appreciation of how much you are giving them. They just don't. So God did not want the relationship to just be taken for granted. So he set up a system that you can earn that goodness. You can earn that relationship. We all know that in truth, the deeper the relationship is when it's earned. If you don't work for it, easy come, easy go. That's perhaps somewhat of a commentary on some of the difficult relationships that people have today, because it's not built on enough depth. It's just whatever was convenient or easy at the time. But if you have to earn it, you have to work at it, you actually have to communicate with the person and develop the relationship, then you have something stronger, much stronger. So therefore, God did not create robots to just go ahead and dispense God's goodness. Why? Because what's the point? So rather, he creates a creature that is put in a difficult situation. I'm going to give them two options. I'm going to give them free will and freedom of choice. I'm going to create the possibility of him to choose to go against me. Think about that. We're talking about God, who can do anything, purposely setting up a situation that says, I'm giving man such a tool, such power, that he can choose to reject even me and live a life without me. I will give him that choice. Will I, God, suffer because of it? No, I'm God. But will the world suffer because of it? Maybe. But I have to give mankind that option. I have to give them that choice so that they could choose, willfully, voluntarily choose to have that relationship with me. How is the relationship earned? By following what the parent asks. By following what God asks. That's the Torah. That's mitzvot. Those are commandments. It's not there just to make life miserable of do's and don'ts. And if you do it right, great, you catch reward. If you don't, you get punished. It's much more than that. God is giving us an opportunity to earn the relationship and deepen the relationship with him. But very quickly, I want to clarify, how do we exercise our free will? Is it any time that I choose between two things? If I go to the store, remember when we used to do that? But if I go and, I'm sorry, I'll put it more relevant. If you're you're clicking on your shopping cart, right? And you choose the vanilla ice cream over the chocolate ice cream. Have you exercised your free will? So the answer very quickly is no. You have exercised a choice, but that's not necessarily free will. Well, there are certain things that you have that are inherent temperament. That's how you were born. You were born with certain, in Hebrew we call it netiot. You have a proclivity towards certain things. That wasn't your choice. Your choice, that's real choices, are things that fall into the good versus evil, the moral dilemmas. Choosing vanilla over ice cream is something animals do too. The option, or I should say, this gift of free will is unique to mankind. Animals don't have free will. They have certain likings. They have instincts. They have things that they prefer. They like that cat food and not the other. Finickies, right? But that's not free will choice. Moral decisions, how we make those kind of choices. That's where God told us choose life. Didn't say choose good. He says choose life. So how do you define that? So very simply, everyone naturally chooses good. That's natural. Hitler, in his mind, chose good by getting rid of what he considered the scum of the earth. If you were to ask him honestly, do you think what you're doing is classified as good? He will answer you 100% earnestly, yes. What then? Who am I to tell him that he's wrong? Because my definition is different? Therefore, I don't use that definition. Everyone naturally chooses good. Rationalizing our activities as good is an easy trick we do all the time. I'll tell you what the definition is. Life and death. Life is moral decisions that move towards God, or an effort to grow and improve. And death are moral decisions that move us away from God and escape from the effort to accomplish. You cannot control the circumstances that you have, but you can control your reaction to them. That's where you get to exercise. Every single time I do something good or bad, no. This is an important idea. Let's use me as an example. Thank God, I can't say that it's out of the realm of possible, but I think, thank God, that for the most part, eating kosher for me is already a done deal. It's something that, thank God, I've been doing my whole life. I have no intention of giving it up. I'm not grappling. I don't live in a community where it's more difficult to get kosher. I live in Baltimore. The ability to get kosher is much simpler. Is it still a challenge? Yes, to a small degree. But it's not I'm grappling. I have two equally charged positions that I could take. I don't walk into a grocery store and the only options are some old package of Meal Mart, who knows what, versus the fresh meat in a non-kosher. I don't face that challenge. So for me, my choosing kosher, while I chose it, I'm not really grappling with it. As opposed to speaking Lashon Hara, speaking gossip and negatively, it's still something I grapple with. Usually right after this call, I tell Ilana, my wife, I tell her all what everybody was doing on the Zoom call. I speak Lashon Hara for about 18 minutes afterwards, and I'm good to go till the next class. Okay? It's still something I grapple with. For me, the moral decision of holding my tongue back from speaking negatively is something that I currently grapple with. So yes, my choosing to eat kosher falls into the technical category of free will choice because I'm choosing to move closer in my relationship to God because of it, but I'm not grappling with it. This is something Rabbi Dessler explains so beautifully with an analogy. When you have two countries that are at war, where is the battle being fought? The battle is being fought at what we call the battlefront. Just that area between the two armies, where the two of them are banging head to head. Good. In today's modern warfare, we've extended that area, but you still have the same battle lines. The area behind country A that's not technically in the war is already part of country A's country. The area behind country B's front line, that already is captured by country B. That's not where the fighting is taking place. The fighting is only taking place at the point of contention, of where there's a battle going on. The free will choice, what we call bechira, chafshit, free choice, the most we are able to manifest it is right at that free will point of where I'm grappling. That's my most important point of where I'm choosing what to do right now. And folks, every time you make a choice, you're like the army that is able to move forward another mile because it's conquered that area. And now the battlefront is a mile further down the road. You've captured it. Doesn't mean you can't retreat and give up that area also. And every time you make free will choices, you make moral decisions, you are moving the battlefront. That free will point is constantly changing. The goal is to move in the right direction. Might there be times where we make the wrong choice? We've chosen, right? For me, now that they're counting on me in the minyan, we have an outdoor minyan. There's only 13 of us. And if I decide to take Memorial Day off and blow off davening, well, there's a possibility three other guys may choose to do that. And then there's no minyan. So my free will choice tomorrow morning is get your tuchus out of bed, Tachman, because they're counting on you. I know you're tired. Tough luck. But it's a choice I have to make. This is where, when we talk about free will and having a reward and a punishment based on it, it's because these actions matter. It makes a world of difference. It's a moral battlefront. It's only at the point of challenge. Again, the majority of they're not where the clash is taking place. I would venture to say that everybody on this call, being part of a high holiday service, is not a major. Yes, I'm sure it's challenging, but it's not your point of real challenge. I know everybody on this call, you've all committed to this concept. Judaism isn't something new to you. There are certain basics you just don't give up on. You don't forgo it. I would venture to say unless you have a medical reason, everybody here is fasting on Yom Kippur. That's, yes, you are exercising free will, but not to the extent that it's the real challenge. Keeping Shabbos, keeping kosher to whatever extent, those are the real battles that each one of us is facing, even those of us who've been doing it for years. It's a constantly changing free will point. Make a positive choice, you raise it the higher level. It's like gaining territory in the battle. Making a negative choice, choosing to move away from godliness, choosing to allow a certain moral decadence to seep into your decision-making, well, then you're surrendering territory. What used to be a struggle is now, unfortunately, easy as pie and letting it go. We all know that from our attempted New Year's resolutions and diets. Once you, oh my God, you get off that bandwagon, you are messed for who knows how long, right? Don't let that happen. Okay, you retreated a little bit, but pick yourself up, get back and fight that battle and get that territory back. This is why. These are the consequences. When this principle tells us that God gave us, for those who make the right choice, there's reward, yes, because my actions matter. And my moral decisions is what makes the most matter. That's what matters most. We're not done with the topic because there's still two other major topics, and I'll follow up with questions if you want regarding free will. But there's two other parts to this, and we have to understand that. There's also the part of where is this reward and punishment meted out? Is it here in this world? Is it the next world? We got to deal with that. And then the question that was brought up last week in terms of, well, I define good and reward or punishment and evil. How do you have a situation of somebody who's doing everything good and yet something negative seems to happen? We got to deal with all of this. But this is a big, big, big topic. And I hope at least for tonight, I've whet your appetite that this is an important idea in terms of how we exercise our free will. Let me open up to questions. I know it's very late. Randy. One second, I got to unmute you here, sorry. Go ahead.
So are we supposed to ask ourselves when we have that moral decision to make, which action would bring us closer to Hashem?
I think ostensibly, yes.
Okay.
I mean, but let's be honest. Isn't that in fact what we do when we ask ourselves a dilemma? I know we may not translate it and it says, what will bring me closer to God? What we do is we ask ourselves, what's really the right thing to do in this situation?
Exactly.
That's really the question we ask ourselves. But technically, it's really one and the same because what makes it right? Again, Hitler thought what he did was right. I can't use just my subjective definition. I have to use an objective term here. So anything that I know is moving me in the right direction towards God is by definition choosing life. That's really the moral dilemma of choosing right. Batsheva.
Okay. Is there ever a point of choice where there's no wrong?
What do you mean?
I mean, oftentimes, even in religion or whatever, there's two paths that don't necessarily, it's not like go to shul or don't go to shul. It's go to this one or go to that one.
So you're asking, can there be more than one way to have a right choice?
Yeah.
Yes. The answer is yes. There are different ways. I mean, Judaism, I think, again, some people look at it and see so many splinter groups. You have Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, and you have Hasidim and Litvaks, and you have this group and that group. I don't see it that way. What I see is an amazing ability that we can find paths to God and with different ways. It doesn't preclude that there's only one right answer. There's 600,000 letters to a Torah. Each one of us has our unique way. But obviously there are guidelines. I can't just make up my own thing. But yeah, there's no one right answer. There are so many ways to get to God. But there is, Batsheva, there is always a wrong choice. There is a wrong choice. in that situation, if going to the other shul is not really for my benefit, because in that shul, it's nonstop talking and very little praying, I'm not so sure that's the right choice. Sure, it's a shul, but you have to look at the whole picture. There's always a right choice. There may be more than one, but there's also a wrong choice.
Okay.
What's going to bring me closer in the relationship? Yes or no? That's the question. Is my action going to bring me closer? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, based on all the circumstances that you're aware of, then yeah, that's a right choice.
But I guess also what I'm trying to ask is, like, is there a way to catch up? Meaning, yeah. If you think of something like the concept of sliding doors or the butterfly effect, where if you make this wrong choice now, can you catch up to the right choice later?
Yeah, that's the, of course you can. You can always change. Free will means you can change. Teshuvah, repentance, means you have the ability to change. Okay, I did this for all my years. Do you really expect me at age 85 to start changing? Why not? Have you given up on life? Good. Should I have started when I was 15? Okay, but you can't change that, but I can start now. You always have a choice, always. Until your last dying breath, you have a choice to make, always. Susan.
So if someone who wasn't Jewish, or even someone who is Jewish, would ask how Judaism defines morality, it seems like the answer, based on our conversation today, is always whatever action goes in the direction toward God and is the moral choice.
Correct. I wrote here once. I have to see if I can find it. I have so many papers there. It's a big topic. I had a definition here once. Hold on. See if I still have it. Here. I wrote the definition from, right? It's a conscious decision to follow good and reject evil based on God's laws.
Say that again.
A conscious decision to follow good and reject evil based on God's laws.
That's the choosing life.
Right? That's choosing life. Let me, unless there's any other question, I want to read you one last story. Sid, you had your hand up. One second. Oh, I lost you. One second, Sid. You got to unmute. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
In lesson 10, we were talking about the Ashrei prayer, and you said that it contains all the letters of the Hebrew alphabet.
Except the letter Nun.
Right, and you said we will get to that one later, and it's later.
Yeah, but not late enough.
Okay, so it's coming. Preview,
it might be
so
after all these principles.
Okay.
let me finish with this story. It's really a beautiful story about how our choices are making it all happen. An elderly carpenter was ready to retire. He told his employer contractor of his plans to leave the house building business and live a more leisurely life with his wife, enjoying his extended family. He would miss the paycheck, but he needed to retire. They could get by. The contractor was sorry to see his good worker go and asked if he could build just one more house as a personal favor. The carpenter said yes, but in time, it was easy to see that his heart was not in his work. He resorted to shoddy workmanship and used inferior materials. It was an unfortunate way to end a dedicated career. When the carpenter finished his work, the employer came to inspect the house. He handed the front door key to the carpenter and said, "This is your house, my gift to you." The carpenter was shocked. What a shame. If he had only known he was building his own house, he would have done it all so differently. So it is with us. We build our lives a day at a time, often putting less than our best into the building. Then with a shock, we realize we have to live in the house we have built. If we could do it over, we'd do it much differently, but we cannot go back. You are the carpenter. Each day you hammer a nail, place a board, erect a wall. Life truly is a do-it-yourself project, someone said. Your attitude and the choices you make today build the house you will live in tomorrow. Build wisely. We'll pick this up tomorrow night.
Thank